Doamna Braș, vă mulțumesc pentru amabilitatea cu care ați acceptat să oferiți acest interviu Europei Libere cu puțin timp înainte de a se împlini o lună de la invazia Rusiei în Ucraina. Acum 10 ani ați fost în fruntea misiunii OSCE în Republica Moldova. Ce șanse avea atunci soluționarea problemei transnistrene și ce perspectivă de reglementare ar putea să apară acum pe 2 martie? S-au împlinit 30 de ani de la izbucnirea conflictului armat de la Nistru. Credeți că se apropie momentul identificării unei soluții durabile pentru acest dosar transnistrean?
First of all, Valentina, I just have to tell you it's a pleasure to talk to you again and thank you so much for thinking of me. Moldova is never far from my mind, in particular in these days when Moldova is in the newspapers, international newspapers, American newspapers, practically every day. Let me just say as a preface that what Russia is doing to Ukraine has effects on the entire world. In fact, it's almost a destruction of the liberal world order that was set up after World War II to prevent wars and to prevent neighbors from attacking neighbors in Europe like Russia is doing to Ukraine right now. So the effects of this Russian attack and Russian invasion are far-ranging. Of course, the effects are much more dramatic for those countries that are bordering on Russia and bordering on Ukraine, like Moldova. And it's even more pressing for Moldova that Moldova also has a breakaway part, Transnistria, that has caused instability for Moldova for decades now. You asked me, I think, 10 years ago what I saw the chances for resolving the Transnistrian conflict. I think the chances 10 years ago were the best that they had ever been. In fact, when I took the job as head of mission, we were very excited in Washington about really the prospects for resolving a festering conflict. We had many things that we were optimistic about. First of all, me. I was a new head of mission. I was a woman at the time. There was a focus on women in leadership positions in OSCE and the UN and throughout NATO and the EU space. There was a new election in Transnistria, as you remember, with Mr. Shevchuk becoming president. He was considered a young, dynamic leader who might be more interested in the fortunes of the people in Transnistria than his predecessor. And the 5+2 negotiations were starting up again after they'd been halted for quite some time. And we were also very lucky, I might add, at that point to have the Irish as chairman in office. And the Irish had a lot of examples to give us about their dealings with Northern Ireland or the Irish conflict. And they were very instructive to me that when you resolve a conflict, it doesn't mean that everybody's going to start sitting at the same cafes and dating each other and marrying each other. You just find a way to live together so that the people in those areas can pursue a normal, productive, and I hope democratic life. So I think we were very realistic about what we could produce from reintroducing the 5+2, and we were optimistic. I would say the first couple of meetings, we produced some results, first results, getting people to sit at the table. But I think those expectations rapidly came apart when we saw, I have to be honest, very little willingness from either side, the Moldovan side or the Transnistrian side, to really work on lasting solutions. And I was critical at the time of the Moldovan government. I said, you know, you're going to have to be a bit more forthcoming, a bit more welcoming. You need to prepare your public to reintroduce Transnistria to Moldova. So I was frustrated with the performance of the Moldovan government at that time. I saw a bit of a lack of will. The Transnistrian government was not independent from Russia at that point, as we thought they might be. We learned quite quickly that they were 100% controlled by Moscow and the Russian negotiators. So that bit of euphoria we had at the beginning of my tenure, thinking we could find a lasting, sustainable, durable solution, I would say that did not last longer than a year when we started running into the same problems that really this Berlin process has found itself in many years later.
Recent, adunarea parlamentară a Consiliului Europei a declarat Transnistria drept teritoriu ocupat de Federația Rusă. Ce impact poate avea această decizie și credeți că acest lucru îl poate face, spune și OSCE?
Well, I have a lot of respect for the Council of Europe, of which the United States is just is not a member, just an observer, I believe. And so I think we need to be very serious in considering when the Council passes a resolution like this. It is a big change calling Transnistria Russian-occupied territory. You'd really have to look into the logistics of the difference in the wording. It has always been Russian-occupied territory since the conflict broke out and since the Russian peacekeepers came in and since access has been increasingly limited to international observers. So I don't think it's a big change in the actual situation on the ground to call it Russian-occupied. I really can't speak on behalf of the OSCE. We have a very good ambassador to OSCE in Vienna, and there's a whole office that deals with those issues. So I don't want to speak to whether or not the OSCE should have a similar resolution. But I will say that it's good that Russia was either kicked out or walked out of the Council of Europe. It doesn't belong to be there. It doesn't deserve to be there after, first of all, seizing Crimea in 2014, and then we can go back to invading Georgia before that. But invading Ukraine in the last few weeks does not give Russia the right to belong to the Council of Europe. I would also question Russia's standing in other international organizations. What right does Russia have to be on the Security Council of the United Nations right now, passing judgment on the actions of other countries in the world? So I think Russia's lost the status that it had of belonging to these organizations as a prominent member. I won't speak to how the OSCE should handle Russia, but I would not say that Russia has been a constructive, productive, or truthful member. But I will leave it up to OSCE whether or not they think that issuing that type of declaration is actually helpful.
Formatul de negocieri 5+2, de unii este lăudat, de alții dur criticat, va rezista acest format?
The format of, you're asking about whether the format of 5+2 is the best format we could be using right now. Will the format last? Well, I think in any conflict, the negotiators should be flexible to new approaches. In recent years, I've been much more involved with the Serbia-Kosovo conflict than I've been with Transnistria-Moldova, Moldova-Transnistria. Very different conflicts, to be sure, but there's an ongoing, what they call EU-led dialogue that's been going on since 2012 that, to my mind, has yielded very few concrete results, and they're dealing with almost identical issues to what's going on in the 5+2 negotiation. So a number of us tried to persuade the State Department to take a fresh approach to this dialogue because it clearly was not yielding any results. I think there becomes a bureaucratization of these processes where people are invested in them and they don't want to change them for fear that this is the only thing we've got, so we've got to stick with it, or that another format would be just as successful at, or unsuccessful. But I certainly think new approaches should be considered. They should be examined. They should be evaluated up against the success of 5+2. But the more important element, two more important elements, is no matter how much the negotiators want a settlement, if the actual actors, in this case Moldova and Transnistria, are not interested in a settlement, then there's nothing the negotiators can do to force them to have a settlement. So I would look for leaders in Moldova and Transnistria to express their desire and their will and their political commitment to finding a resolution. It's really not up to the negotiators to push them into a negotiation or a solution if they're not willing or if they're not ready to have a solution themselves. But of course, the more obvious element is that Russia does not deserve to be at that table anymore. Two of the original negotiators, Russia and Ukraine, are at war. I won't say that Ukraine is at war with Russia. I would say Ukraine is defending its sovereign territory against a Russian invasion. And how can you expect two prominent negotiators with that current relationship to sit at a table and try to discuss arrangements for a third country? It just doesn't make sense to me. And I think it's, I don't even know how the Russians can sit down at a table and face their other interlocutors while they're actively killing pregnant women, handicapped people, babies, wiping out cities. No, they don't have a role at the negotiating table. So I do not think in this context, 5+2 is the appropriate format for settling the Transnistrian conflict because the Russians have no credibility.
Să amintim că din acest format fac parte Chișinăul, Tiraspolul, mediatorii Ucraina și Federația Rusă, dar și observatorii Uniunii Europeană și Statele Unite ale Americii. Pe cine avantajează acest format de negocieri 5+2?
Criminals right now. because as long as the situation is not solved or regulated, it leaves the way open for criminals from both sides to be able to smuggle and conduct illegal operations, all to the detriment of the people who live in Moldova, and that includes Transnistria. So the only ones who prosper right now from a lack of resolution are the criminal elements.
În opinia dumneavoastră, care ar fi formatul ideal ca să fie rezolvat problema transnistreană?
I wish I knew the answer to that. I can't imagine any negotiation that includes Russia at this point. I know that the Transnistrians would feel more comfortable if there was a Russian at the table. Maybe they'd feel comfortable with a Ukrainian at the table instead, because, of course, there's large Ukrainian populations in Transnistria as well as Russian-speaking. I would call on the government of Moldova, really, to display more of a commitment, and I know that the current president and prime minister have both recently talked about how they need to find a solution to Transnistria. I'm hoping the new leader, not so new anymore, of Transnistria, Krasnoselsky, would start thinking about the welfare of his people who are leaving, and they've been leaving for quite some time because they see no prospect for a future for the young people in Transnistria. The leaders themselves, the local leaders, have to demonstrate a commitment and a resolve to finding a solution for the benefit of their people who live there, to give their young people a future.
Cunoscătorii dosarului transnistrian consideră că autoritățile Republicii Moldova au făcut cedări mari cu pași mici. Ce credeți dumneavoastră despre acești pași mici care se fac pentru a fi soluționată problema transnistreană?
I know we've been talking about small steps even when I was there, and these eight areas that were identified during the Berlin process, I think they're very beneficial and productive areas that will benefit people on both sides of the river. Of course, I'm delighted to get the bridge open. I'm not sure what the status of it is for international commercial travel, but at least it's made life easier for people living on both sides of the river. So that, I think, was one of the biggest successes of the 5+2 process and the negotiations. That bridge needs to stay open. I'm a little bit dismayed to see that the license plate issue is not 100% resolved. I remember speaking to the Moldovan officials and saying that in America we had 50 license plates, 51 if you count District of Columbia, or even more if you count Puerto Rico and other territories. So I was hoping that the Moldovans could be a little bit more flexible in terms of allowing more freedom of movement. Certainly, the facilities for the Moldovan script schools need to be improved. I'm happy about the farmers being able to work their land. So I'm happy that there's been some progress in those eight areas and that those eight areas have been identified. I'm not sure, however, how progress in those eight areas, those eight small steps, translates into settling the status of Transnistria. And that's really what the big question is. Is what is the status of Transnistria going to be within Moldova? I don't want to keep on referring to Kosovo Serbia, but the Kosovo Serbia dialogue is bogged down by the same issues. Actually, almost identical issues, license plates, freedom of movement. These are the things that help people live their lives on a normal basis. But they don't want to talk about the ultimate status issue either. And I think until that issue is on the table, it's very hard to see how the small steps will lead to a lasting solution or lasting security for the people who live there. It should be a process that continues along with discussing status, but just the small steps alone is not sufficient.
Ținând cont de situația tensionată din regiune, ce soartă poate avea Transnistria dacă în războiul ruso-ucrainean învinge Kievul, să zicem?
What will be the fate of Transnistria if Kiev wins in the current Russian-Ukrainian war? Actually, the entire world is hoping for Ukraine to win. And to win means what? It means to get a foreign power out of their country. It means to defend their own borders. This is an invasion, an unprovoked invasion. If Kiev is successful, which we hope they are, that could only be good for all of the people, not just in Transnistria and Moldova, but in the entire world, to prove that this type of aggression and violation of the entire liberal world order that was established after World War II, when Kiev admits victorious, it is good for the entire world, not just for Moldova and just not for Transnistria. But you want me to be a bit more specific. Of course, if when Kiev succeeds in pushing back the Russians, it will not put the Transnistrian people in the middle of this horrific game. We're all looking right now at Odessa and hoping that that beautiful city, that pearl of a city, World Heritage, is not touched by Russian aggression, Russian violence. Our worst fear is if something happens to Odessa and Russian troops get closer to Transnistria, they will put the Transnistrians in a very difficult position that is very unhelpful for Transnistria. So our hope is, of course, that the Ukrainians can keep the Russians out of Odessa and can continue to push them back, which we're seeing is happening both in the north around Kyiv and also Mariupol and some other places where they're succeeding at huge human and material costs of pushing back the Russians. So when Kyiv succeeds, it will be much better for Transnistria and for Moldova than the alternative of Russia succeeding and then not being satisfied with just destroying Ukraine, but wanting to move further west.
Dar dacă victoria va fi de partea Rusiei lui Vladimir Putin, ce se poate întâmpla cu regiunea transnistreană?
Well, I don't think that Putin will stop there. Lots of the reporting these days is talking about Lviv and threats to Poland, which is a NATO ally, of course, and a very good NATO ally, proving themselves on a daily basis. Certainly the Russians would think that they've paid enough for Transnistria over the years in terms of free energy and higher pensions that Transnistria owes Russia and that Transnistria should help them. And that, of course, puts the Transnistrians in a terrible situation of fighting for Russia against Ukrainians and perhaps even against Moldovans. Should Russia push into Moldova? And I'm reminded of Deputy Prime Minister Rogozin's words when I was there. I was looking for the quote, but I couldn't find it. This was even in 2012, before he was declared PNG. He said, we will carve up Moldova. He threatened that, actually, in 2012. He said, we will carve up Moldova, starting with Gagauzia, and we'll move on to Belz, but Moldova will cease to exist. He's threatened that in the past, a high-ranking Russian official. So I would fear for Moldova. Moldova being a neutral country makes it quite vulnerable. But I also wonder how Romania would respond to that. So it really risks a greater conflict. I'm not sure if Russia wants that, but if it succeeds in Ukraine, which the entire world hopes it does not do, we still don't know what Putin's end game is, what will satisfy him. So we are hoping, and we haven't spoken about this, Valentina, we're hoping that these economic sanctions, which are the strongest sanctions that have ever been introduced in history, will prevent his ability to wage war, that he will be choked off from his revenue streams, and he will no longer be able to afford to wage war. I'm not sure whether we will succeed in convincing the Russian people that what Putin is doing is bad and that he should be stopped, because they're in a complete information blackout. If you're a Russian speaker in Russia, all you receive is Putin's information. If you're an English speaker, perhaps you have a chance of getting other sources of information. But I would say the vast majority of Russians believe what he's saying to them, which is that somehow Ukrainians are fascists and Nazis, which we all know is completely false. So we're hoping that these economic sanctions and also the supply of equipment and assistance to Ukraine will stop the Russian aggression and push him back into Russia's borders. But it's going to be a long struggle, and it will come at enormous human cost.
La doar o zi după ce Maia Sandu, președinta Republicii Moldova, a semnat cererea de aderare la Uniunea Europeană, Tiraspolul a solicitat autorităților de la Chișinău recunoașterea independenței autoproclamatei Republicii Moldovenești Nistrenia. Și tot mai des se pune întrebarea, Moldova în Uniunea Europeană cu sau fără Transnistria?
I don't have the answer to that. You would think that if the leaders in Transnistria actually cared more about the people who live there, and I believe there's still about 300,000, if they cared more about those people than their own personal gain from being in office, you would think that they would look to an EU future. And actually, in the times when an EU future made sense economically to Transnistria, they agreed to an EU future, such as the trade agreements where they can sell their products to Europe. Such as being able to play football, soccer, the sheriff team in Europe. So when they want to be part of Europe, they allow themselves to be a part of Europe. I would think that that indicates that actually they see more of a future in Europe than they would see as part of Russia, especially the kind of Russia that Vladimir Putin is currently running. So I would just hope that the young people of Transnistria, independent thinkers in Transnistria, would realize that if Moldova gets closer to the European Union, that it's better for them to join Moldova than to stay where they are, a thin sliver of land vulnerable to any type of Russian appetite.
Despre planul COSAC, se pare că Federația Rusă nu a renunțat niciodată la acest plan. Credeți că este posibilă o federalizare a Republicii Moldova?
I understand that the word federalism or federation is somehow a negative term in Moldova. When I first got there, of course, I come from a federation where states have incredible rights. And almost any day, there's always kind of a clash between states' rights and national rights. But it's a dynamic that occurs in many federal systems. So I didn't ever understand the allergy to federalism or a federation. But I do understand that it exists in Moldova among decision makers. So it's hard for me to comment on that because I know it's such an allergic point. But if it's not a federation, how to give devolve powers from the central authority in Chisinau to local regions is a challenge for Moldova, but it's one they've got to think about.
Vladimir Putin, liderul de la Kremlin, a spus clar că și-ar dori să reconstituie Imperiul Sovietic, în scurt timp ar dori să reafirme o sferă de influență în jurul țărilor vecine, care au fost cândva parte a blocului sovietic. Care sunt însă intențiile adevărate ale liderului de la Kremlin? Poate el decide viitorul statelor ex-sovietice care s-au desprins de URSS?
One of Vladimir Putin's most famous quotes, very early when he came to power, was that the disintegration of the Soviet Union was a catastrophe for Russia. Now, how anybody could think the collapse of a communist system is a catastrophe is incomprehensible. I know the United States and the West poured billions of dollars into Russia in the 1990s, to create a diversified economy, to try to establish democratic institutions, freedom of the press, freedom of universities, for freedom of thinking. There was enormous amounts of resources put in to trying to give Russia and Russians the opportunity to be a productive democracy. Now, we know today that most of that money, a lot of that money ended up in the pockets of oligarchs, and these are the people who are getting their yachts taken away from them and their private planes. Very little of that money trickled down to the average Russian citizen. That, to me, not the collapse of the Soviet Union, is the biggest catastrophe that ever happened to Russia, is receiving all that money and assistance and having it all stolen by Putin and his oligarchs, and turning Russia into a complete kleptocracy. That's the biggest catastrophe that ever happened to Russia. Now, his dreams of reconstituting the Russian Empire, Soviet Union, whatever you want to call it, yes, he's been talking about that for years. We've always known that that's his plan. But we had thought, up until the invasion of Georgia, then the invasion of Crimea, and now this, that he would respect the institutions of the liberal world order, particularly in the case of Ukraine. When they gave up their nuclear weapons, they gave it up for border security, and Russia signed on to that. But okay, there's so many agreements that they've signed on to and have not lived up to, it's sort of fruitless or pointless to point out that this is a guarantee that Russia, Vladimir Putin, gave. Yes, that's what he wants to do. And that's why I think Moldova needs to be concerned. Somehow he's not looking so hard at Central Asia and Kazakhstan. perhaps they're being more obedient, although now they've had a number of decades of independence. So I'm not so sure they want to be a part of the Soviet Union. We know Central Asians are not treated too well when they go to Moscow or St. Petersburg. But yes, what do you do about a leader like that who has nuclear weapons and who's shown his resolve to violate every international agreement that his country has signed up to? I don't know what you do with him, but I do not believe that he belongs on the Security Council of the United Nations. The United Nations is 100% against the activities, the thinking, the philosophy of Vladimir Putin.
Ce mesaj aveți dumneavoastră pentru cetățenii Republicii Moldova?
First of all, I so much admire what the people of Moldova are doing for the refugees from Ukraine. I know that Moldova does not have a lot of resources, but to be able to welcome that massive number of refugees in such a warm and gracious and caring and empathetic way is truly, truly impressive. So I want to congratulate the people of Moldova for how they've welcomed their Ukrainian brothers and sisters. The second message is democracy. I know you've got a president now, Maia Sandu, who has it, I think, in her DNA that she wants democracy for Moldova. She's got huge challenges in front of her because of the persistent levels of corruption that have really unsettled Moldova over the years. The bank crises and the other corruption crises have just been heartbreaking to watch, because the people who steal money from the people of Moldova for their own personal benefit are not true patriots of Moldova. They're not acting in the best interest of the people there. So I would like to see a genuine effort, and it's difficult under these circumstances, to wipe out corruption, because I think that's the single greatest challenge facing Moldova. It's up, of course, to the leaders of Moldova to address corruption, but it's also up to the citizens themselves not to accept corruption on a daily basis, on a one-to-one basis, on a personal basis.